I'm Maureen Tonkin. I'm delighted to be on the On Talented podcast by Canva and Unknown. I'm the CEO of the first talent agency in the art world and now the leading one globally. We love to rep amazing visual artists and integrate the arts in all contexts.
Imagine I am a 10-year-old or an elderly relative. Please explain to me what you do.
So we're basically reimagining visual environments with art. So on a daily basis, you look at 10,000 images, and as you walk around your streets, you're constantly looking visually. We've integrated over 300 projects in the last 10 years. We imagine every corner of the streets, every screen, everything with artists. And I actually think 10 years old or later, people love us for that reason. It's quite inspiring.
What's something that has helped you move faster in your career?
I think there's different stages to say that. I think in a sense, like being in your early 20s, having no understanding of consequences or the risk that you're taking was incredibly helpful. In the same way that having a bit more wisdom later on is also very helpful in establishing a business. I think it's probably embracing what every age offers. And I've enjoyed every phase so far because I think every age has given me very different insights.
Money talk. Can you please tell us what a top earner can expect to earn in your industry?
So I think at this stage, so first of all, we wanted to tackle that. So we were the first hired agency in the art world because the average salary for an artist in the UK is below 12K a year. So it's really bad, despite actually a creative sector that's bullish and one of the strongest in Europe. And that was the reason why we created new revenue streams for the artists. So away from just selling artworks, you could do public art projects, brand partnerships, digital partnerships, even entertainment partnerships with visual artists. So that's the economics are key. At this stage, we have artists who make seven figures on their projects. And we definitely, you know, so many examples of those artists are also people that actually come from a working class background who are now doing incredibly well, which is another issue, as we know, with the art world, where you tend to have people who come, you know, at large from inherited wealth or privileged networks. So is the economics was a key. It was how do we help more artists thrive? How do we make sure that also we're more transparent about the value of the arts and how to value it and the value of those projects too?
We found that talking about money in the art world is still quite taboo. How have you seen this play out and what do you think are the main factors that are driving this?
Yeah, it's a really interesting. There's a philosophy from the 19th century that actually initially was French, but the Brits kept, called art for art's sake. So the idea for art for art's sake is that if you're a true artist, you should never care about what's outside of the arts and therefore the financial side. I'm all pro-romantics, but the problem is as you can imagine, this is available to just a few who don't have to care about their rent, especially in an inflation and a rise of costs, living crisis, or anyone who doesn't have to think about the production, because a lot of the sculptures that you see are incredibly heavy in production. So I do think we should talk about money. I think we talk about it in not a guilt way. I think that we have artists who come from privileged means. That's not the problem. But in a way that means that, like, again, this is, you're making sure that everyone can slowly but surely have the same access or similar access to opportunities. Whereas right now there's huge disparities according to your socioeconomics from who you know and what funding you will have access to in terms of who can become talented in the sector. And I think for someone who built a talent agency, I want to see who is talented, not who has the means to be talented.
To elaborate on that a bit more, how do you support emerging artists? How do you support the people that you represent?
So at this stage, it's not just emerging, there's also established. So you have different ones. You have the ones on the books, the one that we manage. Obviously, if you manage a talent, you're substantially more involved in their career than if you're on the books. I would like to think that first we give you an exposure to different revenue streams so you can diversify ultimately how you make money through your art. Especially in a time of AI rising and artificial intelligence, like your rights, your IPs, you know, licensing, all of that, all the legal literacy, which is so key. Hopefully we open up loads of new audiences. We have a lot of artists that are now really well followed. And hopefully also there's a psychological support. I think 17 years in, so 10 years into the business, I would like to think that I'm only just starting understanding human beings, like, you know, if it's a constant curve. But I feel therefore, hopefully we give you emotional support, psychological support that is helpful at a time where you need to feel that you have a team behind you.
Did you feel like you had a key driver for wanting to establish NTR?
I felt the idea wasn't there and I felt the idea was obvious. It was less for the drive and more that it just felt so, obvious that this idea should see the light of the day, and it felt very logical. And my brain just couldn't work out why the idea was not there. There's now 38 companies will copy us and do that, which is a really good thing because that means we've opened up new ways to kind of represent artists But it was more the pure logic that I felt the idea could support new ways for artists and new ways for people to access the arts. So it felt very obvious it had to happen.
Is there a specific piece of advice that you would give to emerging artists trying to break out and become on the scene?
Well, I think, you know, we talked about different ages. I don't know if I should give that piece of advice in the sense that I think the fact that they are thinking that everything is possible is probably the reason why they succeed. But as we know, it's a painful, long road to get to be recognized as talent. And not to underestimate and be kind to yourself on the levels of challenges that you have upcoming. But therefore, this is why probably just ignore all of that. Go for it, you know, just go try as much as you can, build those relationships, like be bold in what you're trying to do. Have that mentality that you have nothing to lose. Because I think if you actually listen to my advice, maybe not think too much about it. But I think the truth is that in the same way that there's very few companies that succeed, there's very few artists that will succeed. I think all the jobs that we do, we're incredibly fortunate to have them in the first place.
And we've spoken just before around how you integrate art into public spaces, and that's a big driver for you. How do you measure the success of that?
Yes, I think that's what changed. And I did my first academy paper with Warwick University on that topic. I'm actually launching this month's one with UCL on that exact same topic. And for us, it's again, you know, the art world can be seen as something that's quite decorative and a bit fluffy and superficial, and it's nice to have. We wanted to show that public art was just like having parks in a city. It was something that was actually a right to, and it would change your mental health. It would change the way you approach your area. It would change the way you kind of, you know, emotionally connect where you work and live. So that paper very much measured that. And as we've integrated loads of people that participated in that studies to kind of verify it. When it comes to clients, whether this is real estate, biz, cities, councils will come on board with us to do those public art projects. We want to show that it has increased the traffic that has come to the area. We can define demographics as well. You know, if they have restaurants or retail, that again, this has supported ultimately their local businesses. It has supported the perception of the area, has made it more of a stronger destination. And all the soft power that we know the arts have, on top of, obviously, of the basic social media and press kind of coverage that will also be there.
Do you think there's one factor that you see a massive increase of because of promoting art in public spaces?
I think for the last 10 years is a better understanding what public art stands for. You know, we are by now doing a podcast in East London, where my first boss, Silas, I discovered Banksy, and I was like the hub of street art in a sense. And I remember like being much younger, visiting the studio of Conor Harrington, where street art was just emerging in that area. And I'm so grateful to the street artists because they have shown us that they can transform an area. East London was fully transformed thanks to the street artists, the same way that Lisbon was transformed through Vils and all the other street artists. So I think first we are now more aware that the culture that the area is carrying has an unusual amount of value. Now, I think our second battle is to preserve it. In the same way that the East London has had this back and forth on how do we keep the creators within it, I think, and especially with the conversations around London, is how do we keep creators in them now that we can value better the importance of public art? Let's make sure that we retain everyone else part of the city.
Have you found that there are more challenges in promoting visual artists in the digital age?
If you think pre-social media, the only way in which you could be spotted was to exhibit at a gallery. Now, that access is super hard. You have to have a family member or a friend that has a gallery or connection because, as you can imagine, there's very few HR application processes in the sector. Suddenly, like, if I think of our artist like Derek Obertang from Ghana, he can just build his audiences and profile and be spotted and start exhibiting in museums and galleries, right? So this is a game changer, not just in terms of, you know, like, the business itself, but actually who gets to have a voice and at a socio-economic level or at a cultural level. So that should definitely be seen as a positive. But yes, I can understand that therefore it comes an added pressure. I can understand that also suddenly you're flooded with artists, whereas before that was very few. But competition and abortus kind of run hand in hand.
How have you found as a business that you best navigate that?
Again, first it was a game changer because a PR company is incredibly expensive when you start a business as a founder. So I was able to not have one and use social media to start building up a community. And also that loyalty for that community is one that will support you in buying the works first and elevating the business as well. Even when I travel, like I will be saying, I'm going on those dates and I'll be introduced to new artists and new people. So it's a power of community. And I think we were a generation where we started to build powerful communities, and you could do that even if you were outside of the initial networks or gatekeepers. So it's incredibly powerful. I'm sure there's downsides, you know, like in a sense, I'm a classic millennial founder that did a lot on social media. I'm sure there's downside to it. But I think for me, the downside are probably 2% versus a 98% that has transformed my life of having got a powerful community that supported my business. So I could never see that negatively.
It's also, like you were saying, the power of community and not just using it as a platforming tool, but using it to build that network and to generate conversation.
Yeah, you're not speaking at, you're speaking with, and you're building with. And I felt, you know, I very much felt part of the founders where we were starting to build businesses with. But also it feels nice. It feels nice to feel like, you know, I get regular messages on why they care about what we do and how they feel about it. And it also removes a pure business transactional relationship. There's, of course, loads of different clients I look after. But there's also a community of people that approve of the work and goes and see it. And they're just as valuable to me on both fronts.
Please, could you discuss more of the role of art in shaping societal narratives?
Like I mentioned earlier, from the 10,000 images that you look at daily, the majority of them are commercial. Again, the idea is not to ban commercial imagery, but to say that because it's a majority, that sadly does lead to a decrease of mental health because you're constantly fed new desires that you have to attain to. Art and nature and exposure to birds does the total opposite. You know, I'm sure you have it. We're after a busy day. And I think, you know, we are in one of the few cities in the world where there's one tree per person. And then, of course, it's all distributed equally. But if you're next to a Hyde Park, it's incredible to have like suddenly all that surface that you can walk after a long day and feel better. Art is exactly the same. And I think we're in a time also where we go straight into binary thinking. And art is one of the few places left where you can come at it and like something different from that public work, but you could still be looking at it together. And you still have a sense that therefore there's a conversation that's happening in center of you still that is special. Not to get to diminish all the conversation that we're having, but also you memorize barely 15% of what you hear, which is totally fine. And obviously we won't take it personally today, but you memorize 60% of what you see, and that shapes you substantially more in terms of how you're going to believe into something or dress a certain way, consume a certain way, or even adopt certain types of behavior. So I think instilling constantly new visual narrative that our conversations through art are really important. And also the empathy. I mean, it's endless in terms of the beauty of having art in a city, and not to mention, especially in London, that you also then have a creative sector employing lots of people that are creators. And, you know, I think having creative as neighbours or within your city is a pretty good thing.
Has there been a key slogan to your life?
Everything I read or look at seems to be around that constructive anger. And I think that constructive anger is a moral ambition to want to change things for the better. It's that commitment that you have that fuels you to want to change things. There's a direct impact that is net positive from that anger. So I think since I've listened to that, I'm picking onto maybe I think that's to do with something like this.
And a question that we are enjoying asking everyone is, what is the weirdest thing that you've used ChatGPT for?
I am very attached to my critical thinking. And obviously I published a book about visual critical thinking. So I'm worried about having a crutch. ChatGPT, I think, will probably for me be a deep search. So going, scanning through all the academic papers on a topic and having that efficiency. But I think my brain is something that I really like, and I enjoy the process of it. So I don't think I'm that person now, and I am married to someone that's dyslexic and a brilliant VC who is totally opposite. And I have seen how much she's enjoyed asking the most random questions. But unfortunately, you're asking the wrong person.